This is a brief meeting held at the Briggs residence on Wednesday, October 22nd. A brief memorial service for Gunther Scraggs, followed by a philosophical discussion by Franklin Wolf.
Thus I have read that the Blessed One has said, "Do not assert anything as true merely because you have heard it, even though it is said by the ancients, by the supposed authorities, by the gods or Davids, or by myself. Always say when you speak of these things, 'Thus I have heard.'" And so it has become a rule in the Buddhist sutras that they always start with that phrase, "Thus I have heard." Speak only as in terms of your own knowledge when you yourself know. This is part of it. It's also implied. Thus, if you have an experience, such as seeing a lake, you may report that as your own knowledge, as a sense impression, provided you don't interpret that sense impression. The experience of a mirage is authentic as sheer experience. It is no longer authentic, or may not be any longer authentic, when you make the judgment it is a lake. Again, if you read a mathematical theorem and go no further, you can say, "Thus I have heard." But if you read the theorem, go through the proof or devise a proof, then you may say, "This I know to be true." If the fundamental assumptions of that mathematical system are also true. This is in the ordinary field of speech. And most of the things we speak of in our daily conversation and in our thinking is of the order, "Thus I have heard." Every bit of history that we have read is "Thus I have heard," unless you went back there and had the experience yourself. Incidentally, something that can be done. Now we are concerned with not this ordinary field of sensuous perception and conceptual cognition, but with another zone. Long ago, while sitting in seminars at in the Graduate School of Philosophy at Harvard, I became convinced that there must be a third organ of cognition that would lead to the resolution of the problem that could not be finally resolved by the use of only the two organs of sense perception and conceptual cognition. It led to the decision to abandon an academic career if that was necessary and it proved to be necessary, and make the search for this possible third organ of cognition. Ultimately, success was achieved. but it took 24 years and a considerable doubt during that time as to whether I'd made a wise choice. The basis of this other way of cognition is in a function which I have called, and Sri Aurobindo has called, realization. I've also used a synonymous term called recognition in the sense of recognition. I've had, during the period from 1922 to 1936, five progressively inclusive realizations. These are, and they're reported in pathways. These are, first, I am Atman. Now, of course, in the philosophic sense, I'm familiar with the conception. I fully accept it in the ordinary conceptual sense. It is the result of self-analysis, which is so highly developed in the philosophy of Sri Shankara Acharya. But on one night, on one occasion, when a friend of mine was going through the same analysis, I suddenly had that which is realization, which contrasts with merely a conceptual acceptance. It's a sense, this, I know, not only that, with it, a sense of delight, exaltation, another dimension of consciousness superimposed upon this ordinary consciousness. It becomes a cornerstone of your fundamental conviction. You say, now, this I know. Before, all I could say was, this I believe because it appeals to me as reasonable. Later, on the occasion of being introduced through Brunton's book, A Search in Secret India, to a certain yogin known as Maharshi, not the one that's known today as Maharshi, another one took that name. This one was in southern India. He was really an orthodox traditionalist yogin, essentially following the line of Shankara. I developed through my concentration upon him, I was very much interested, a certain inner rapport. And out of that grew this realization, again, with a sense of assurance and delight. I am Nirvana. Rather surprised me. Third, 1936, once standing on the banks of the El Dorado Creek, I was looking up at the sky, and all of a sudden it dawned upon me that reality was there where there seemed to be naught, and that where there seemed to be fullness, the mountains, the creek about me, the cabin, and all that, this was emptiness. A relative emptiness. Out of that grew the formulation, substantiality is inversely proportional to ponderability, our appearance is inversely proportional to reality. It is only this year, a few months ago, that I got the first verification that this also has been a recognized principle. And this is in the Voice of the Silence, where it says, study the voidness of the seeming fall and the fullness of the seeming void. I've merely added what is essentially a mathematical quality that belongs to modern conception, the notion of a variable voidness and a variable fullness, that there is not simply an absolute jump from an unconditional emptiness to an unconditional fullness, but that there is a sort of a continuum of gradation. And our modern language, which in this case grows out of calculus, can express that, and I don't think they had that back in those days. So I use that formulation, which suggests Sir Isaac Newton, that appearance is inversely proportional to reality. That means the stronger the appearance, the less reality there. The more subtle the appearance, the more reality there. Until, in the absolute blank to ordinary consciousness, there is complete reality. Now, what does this lead to immediately? That space is not empty, but is a plenum. Not a fullness to our senses, but a fullness in reality. And that when we are over on the other side, cognize the other way, space is filled. A plenum means fullness. That's one consequence. I got the verification. Now, you're always happy to get a verification. You know, in the history of mystical experiences, it's often reported that one has the experience and the great assurance at the time, but when he comes out of the state, he just wonders whether he's quite sane. The story is told of Traubel, who had been a chela of Walt Whitman, that he was on the ferry between Camden and Philadelphia when suddenly he awoke. And in a state of transcendental bliss, was just as much up in the stars as on the ferry and on the water. And it was a glorious experience of a new work, new realization. Here is the beauty and here is the truth. At the end of the boat trip, he forgot to get off till one of the deckhands reminded him he got off. And he came out of the state, and then he began to wonder whether he had gotten off the deep end. So he went to see his guru, Walt Whitman. Walt Whitman instantly saw in his face that something great had happened to him. And Traubel said, I don't know what has happened. I don't know whether I'm right or not. Walt Whitman said, no, at last you are sane. On August 7th, 1936, I was reading in the System of the Vedanta, which is a book by Paul Dyson based upon the philosophic writings of Shankara. Oh, incidentally, Ginta has that book. I would like it back.
I would also like that, but I don't know.
My reading on that day in the section on liberation, all of which seemed very clear, and all of a sudden dawned upon me that that which I was seeking, and this is the realization known as self-realization, that pattern, there are the patterns, suddenly dawned upon me that I am already that which I seek, and therefore there is nothing to be attained. And at that moment, heaven opened up. The key to attainment is the realization that there's nothing to be attained, I found. Now, you've got to get used to paradoxes in this field. In one sense. Now, let me go into a little elaboration here. In the Tibetan Book of the Dead, in the footnotes on pages 96 and 97, you come across a discussion of two Tibetan terms. One is Rig-pa, R-I-G-pa, defined as the essential pure consciousness. Another term is Shi-rig, S-H-E-E-S-R-I-G, meaning the cognitive aspect of consciousness. Now, I've been familiar with this distinction, and I use my own terms, but the first time I ever run on to terms meaning the same thing used by someone else. And it was a wonderful discovery. The pure consciousness involves more than simply cognition. I call it substantive consciousness, meaning the substance of all things that are. Now, when you're dealing with your Buddhist sutras and you run across the words voidness, shunya, shunyata, and so on, which is the Sanskrit term corresponding to voidness, here is the key to understanding it. That considered as an existence apart from consciousness is entirely void. Nothing at all. And that's the thing to be impressed upon. It is real as an existence in consciousness. Now, our tendency to give to the object an existence apart from consciousness is the thing that is here driven against in the emphasis of its nature as being void, entirely void. But it's not void in the sense that it is in consciousness. The substance of it, therefore, we call consciousness, but not the consciousness we ordinarily think of as a relationship between a knower and an object. Now, this is not easy philosophy. It is something that is very fundamental to understanding what's involved in Buddhism, which I would say now is the most fundamental point of view of all, even more fundamental than the Advaita Vedanta, which I'd say is the next most fundamental. Now, that consciousness is a self-existence, not made Another name for it is Buddha nature. And in that sense, since the ultimate substance or essence of which we are composed and all things are composed is that Buddha nature. In that sense, it is said, and I reaffirm it, that we are already Buddha. Every creature is already Buddha, but does not know it. When, however, Shri, the cognitive aspect of consciousness, coalesces with Rigpa, then one attains conscious Buddhahood. This is Buddhist language I'm using right now. Buddhahood is innate in one sense and attained in another sense. There you get the resolution of that statement. The key to attainment was the realization that there was nothing to be attained. The nothing to be attained was the innate sense in which one is already Buddha or Buddha nature. The attainment consisted in the other part of consciousness achieving recognition of it. Now that's the resolution of a paradox, that the key to attainment is the realization that there is nothing to be attained. When you're dealing in this field, you've got to get familiar with paradoxical forms, for you're in a realm where that which here is separated into the pairs of opposites is no longer separated. But to express it in the language that belongs to the field of duality, you have to assert that it is this, and in some sense that which is even the opposite of this. And they both drew at the same time. And resolution of that duality, of that paradox, is one of the keys to growth to a higher level of cognition, cognizing on a higher level. Now this realization, which I reported in the opening section of Pathways, called The Light Breaks Forth, I described as arising above space, time, and law into the root from which these forms are projected. It is therefore an experience of liberation. It follows the pattern of Shankara's yoga. All right. And that, you find in the literature, is identified with moksha, which is the Hindu term corresponding to the nirvana of the Buddhist. Now you know the voice of the silence says, this can be attained, I'm great to see you can, but there's something better. Is it enough that one individual should attain liberation from all the misery of samsaric existence and let all the multitude suffer? There already is the sense that in the Atman, I am not separate from the others. The I in me is identical with the I in all creatures. The individual Atman is only in appearance. It is identical in reality with the universal Atman. The individual Atman is merely the little sun shining in the dewdrop. The universal Atman is the sun. And the little sun in the dewdrop, the individual Atman, is identical with the sun. That is the universal Atman. That can be so strong that in the outer, higher level of consciousness, when you're up, it even occurred to me, how do I know that I'll return to the same entity below? Because I am so completely one with every self whatsoever. It might happen I return in someone else, find myself identical there. But somehow I did manage to return to this one. I don't know how that happened either. Well, this opened a door to an extreme ananda. It's impossible, absolutely impossible, to describe or say anything about the quality of feeling in this consciousness. You can say something about the noetic element. You can't about this feeling. You can give something of the valuation feel with respect to it, and you would say, one moment of this is worth a lifetime of suffering, namely, many lifetimes of suffering. It sounds extravagant. It isn't. And if you read the mystical literature, you'll find that repeated again and again. It's certainly authentically true. There's nothing in our relative imagination that can suggest the feeling value that comes in that state. But I discovered very soon that it carried an energetic value. And that quality of consciousness put a load on the physical organism. It would feel wonderful in the state, and afterwards it felt exhausted, a strain. And so I learned to tone it down. Actually, these things can be controlled by the will. The will is very powerful. You can permit a limited amount of ananda till it's tuned down to what the organism can take without feeling strained. There is a temptation to let yourself go into the full force of it, and I think if one did, it's just to burn out that organism. Then you get disgusted with the fact of a physical organism. Here, this darned animal thing is keeping me from going into this wonderful thing. And you have a strong feeling as though you like to shuck it off, get rid of it. I've been disciplined in the message of the voice of the silence there at the very end, that it is not enough. And I also felt to liberate oneself and leave other fractions of consciousness bound, where you've reached a point where you can do something about it. And there it says that those who reach this point and have renounced the full enjoyment of the nirvanic state of consciousness form a guardian wall around humanity that has kept humanity from sinking into conditions far worse than those that now exist. But those who form the guardian wall are not too numerous. And it would be far better if there were more in that guardian wall. a lot of this humanity would be better. If there were more who strove toward that end. But it is pictured that this calls for renunciation, the greatest of all, without compensation. Now, if one gets either gets a threshold of, you know, nirvana and has these experiences of which I've spoken, and along with that, a kind of knowledge, it's truly called the noetic kind of knowledge. You may have to look that word up in your dictionary. It comes from the word nous. The prospect of turning your back on that looks pretty grim. I can testify to that. Not for a lifetime. Say a million years to make it concrete. That looks appalling. However, I thought it's the only thing to do. We had contact at that time with one of the brothers. He wasn't on this plane. He said, watch for a cycle involving 33. He didn't say 33 what? 33 days, weeks, months, years. I thought it wouldn't be 33 days. I had no idea. Well, I was having a very happy time, 33 days. After a while, he suggested I start to write it up. That's how Pathways got started. I had no inclination to write. He said it'd be a good idea. After I got started, well, it began to write itself. One day I'd been very busy writing. My mind had been very active. My mind was very active that night when I went to bed. And then, after going to bed, something opened up. I didn't have the faintest idea was impending. I wasn't seeking anything whatsoever. I thought I had hit the top. And here was something so much vaster. Never heard of it. And it just walked in on me. That's what I call the high indifference. It's an awfully difficult thing to try to formulate. There was a visitation 33 days later that made it possible for me to formulate what is now in Pathways. My first effort was not very good. Now, there was an inversion here. It was not a movement towards outstanding bliss. It seemed to be more a movement that is in the line of a relative extroversion from a deep introverted position. And it occupied a position intermediate between bliss and suffering, and involved an attitude of equality or indifference to whether one entered into a zone of suffering or a zone of bliss. Now, that's an incredible thing. But in that state of consciousness, one could move towards torture or bliss equally indifferent. I'm merely reporting what I know about the state. I'm not saying this personal organism feels that way. But that's the state. What I call indifference really is equivalent to what Aurobindo means by equality. Equality of attitude. The keynote of this state of consciousness was equilibrium. Not ecstatic bliss, but equilibrium. A uniting of all pairs of opposites whatsoever, including the pair of opposites known as samsara and nirvana. A great, steady equilibrium, absolute equilibrium. no possibility of any distortion without its immediate correction. I had one experience in which I was trying to formulate a state of consciousness where that which corresponds to our thought seemed to be a indeterminate flowage in consciousness. A flowage that seemed to involve the infinite. And I tried to get a verbal concept that would suggest it. I thought of one, and immediately I saw that it was equally the opposite of that concept. And then an autonomous process brought about a synthesis between this assertion and that opposite, so they were integrated. But that was a kind of particularization, so the process was repeated. And there was the negation of that particular integration, and a further integration of that thesis and negation. It was the Hegelian dialectic working autonomously there. So I knew where Hegel had been. You can't capture it in verbal form. Nonetheless, here was a thought, indeterminate so far as conceptual consciousness is concerned, but completely satisfactory. The value in your own realization was complete satisfaction, but you could not tell anybody what in the world it was. That's the reason why these things can't be expressed. The reason why Buddha didn't attempt to formulate them. Because any attempt to formulation is a misformulation. Even if you suggest something, you falsify it. Nonetheless. But since he repeatedly said, it is not this, and not anything else you can think about whatsoever. It is not A, and it's not A, and all of that. A great many people thought he was talking about absolute annihilation, and that wasn't what he had in mind. And so it was necessary to take the risk of formulation, warning at the same time that the formulation is a distortion, and this is true of every shastra whatsoever. No shastric material, that means no sutras, no shastras, no scriptures, can possibly be correct. They can only point. They cannot any more be correct than you can express an irrational number in rational terms completely. I know that definitely. So anybody who takes any shastra in the dead letter sense is off the track. That's aimed at our fundamentalist brothers and sisters. You've got to learn how to use them. They are pointers, all right, but don't hang on. Don't take them in the dead letter sense. No matter how skillful you are, you cannot formulate in conceptual terms correctly. You can only give pointers and indicators. It's not a matter of skill. A skillful person can do a better job than one who's not, but nonetheless, there's falsification goes along. That applies to pathways. It applies to the Bible, it applies to the Bhagavad Gita, and the voice of the silence, and the whole works. Nonetheless, I certainly make use of those sutras. This is a shocking thing to many people. But you cannot hang your security on the dead letter sense of any shastra or scripture whatsoever. You've got to have the courage to dare make the gamble and find it for yourself. The guru may take your hand for a while, but ultimately you'll have to take that gamble. And you don't know beforehand whether you will succeed or whether you'll get into a cul-de-sac. But you got to have the faith and confidence to dare. This is a heroic path. Of course, you're not asked to do it before you're ready. And the guru helps you as far as he can. But ultimately, you've got to make that step yourself. Well, then I had a heck of a time trying to find any literature whatsoever that referred to a state of consciousness that had this quality. There were 3-4 steps in it. One opened up with great satisfaction. Not satisfaction of things, it is just a quality of satisfaction. Almost as though the satisfaction, the abstract quality, was a substance. Something that you could even bestow as a blessing. And after that, it turned into this indifference. Now, that's something I've never been able to communicate to people, so if they like it. Remember when J. William Lloyd, who was the first man who read the manuscript, J. William Lloyd is one of those that appears in Morris Buck's Cosmic Consciousness. He was something of a mystic in his own right. He was a very delightful man, warm, mystic, with a very large human heart. He read it. He couldn't take that in there. He says, I don't see how you can be indifferent. He cooked it in the sense of indifference to the suffering in the world. No, it's indifference in the sense of the Aurobindo's use of the word equality. Equality of attitude towards all things. I can't communicate somehow. It's a state that's very weird in that sense that you feel the same towards anything whatsoever. Well, I've had a good many who have wondered about that particular experience. At the same time, Sharifa was in that room. Sharifa experienced, participated in it. She said the whole room was filled with golden light. I don't have that particular sensorium or capacity to see. It was filled with golden light. She knew something was going on. But she didn't like my formulation at all. She didn't like indifference.
You just answered a question. You just answered a question, but we'll go on to that another time.
Well, then beyond that, there was a stage where I disappeared. That's a sense of I in the sense of Atman, not in the sense of ego. It's a higher level. And the sense of divinity disappeared. Entity. Divine entity. It had persisted up to this point, both. The sense of self-realization is really parallel and in a way identical with God realization. These two dropped off. Only consciousness remained. Now at this point, my language became for the first time identical with Buddhistic formulation. In almost all religions, and in much of Hinduism, the orientation is to an entity, an ultimate entity. And that entity is usually called by one of the names of God. That all springs from an entity. Now in Buddhism, you have what is known as the doctrine of Anatman and the doctrine of Nastikata. In other words, no self, no God. In the place of it is Buddha. Not a man, not now an entity, but enlightenment. That's the real meaning of the word. It's merely attached to one great Buddha in most of our consciousness, but the real meaning is the abstract one of enlightenment. And that's identical with a self-existent consciousness, which is not the consciousness of a being. Entityhood and selfhood then becomes a function of consciousness instead of consciousness being a function of an entity. Now that shifts your whole perspective. I don't believe you can imagine it. Jung, in writing about this in his commentary in the Tibetan Book of the Great Liberation, says he cannot imagine a self-existent consciousness like that, but he says it's found in the Oriental literature. They assert it and so forth, but he says, I cannot imagine it. I cannot imagine a consciousness without a subject. All right, now that'll be your fix in the last analysis. I couldn't imagine it. In the ordinary sense, I can't imagine it now, but I know it is. I can talk about it. I can conceive of it. I can draw the conclusions from it and all of that. But in the ordinary state of consciousness, it seems proper that a consciousness is something that a self produces. But actually, on that level, you find that selfhood, the subject, and along with it, all possible objects of consciousness are derivative from this pure, self-existent consciousness. Now, Jung says, it appears to be true that the unconscious has no center. So there's good reason why it shouldn't have, but we do not find anything corresponding to its center. If then one were to dip into the unconscious and find it as consciousness, it would be a consciousness without a center. So you see, he there has a conception of its possibility, but nonetheless he says he can't imagine it. Now there's a difference between imagining power and conceiving power. We can conceive things, and we do in mathematics right along, in higher mathematics. Conceive things that you can't possibly imagine. You don't believe it, take up the theory of groups. Beyond that, I plunged into darkness. Now, one might be scared doing that. But you ever know, you don't know for sure you'll ever get out of it. Nonetheless, you do have a faith and a confidence, and you have the feeling that the heart of all is a friend. And in a way, you don't care if you never come out anyhow. You go into the depths of that friend. It doesn't matter. And all I could distinguish in that was darkness getting deeper and deeper. I don't know how far I went. Maybe a million miles, but I don't know. Only there are no miles. And up again I popped. Now what I'd say there was this. But at that stage of penetration, the consciousness that is represented by Shirik, which is a developing consciousness, had reached the limit of its capacity and could not make the correlation, so one was in a field of total unconsciousness, which is symbolized by darkness. Another time I was talking to Senior, and he spoke of this unconsciousness. He says, yeah, the brothers have often had discussions about it. It says you would enjoy their conceptions of what is their nature, the level that is unconscious to them. I would think that no matter how far we go up the scale of evolution, there will always be that which is not yet illumined by the two types of consciousness coming together, and so there can always be the experience of this darkness. It's not a hostile darkness at all. It was very friendly, warm darkness. It wasn't the least bit unhappy in it. But nonetheless, I could not bring anything out of it except the sense of a vaster beyond, so that I know the final word of the high indifference is by no means the final word. How vast that beyond is, I do not know. It may be that this is only a little beginning that I have experienced in a way that is illimitable, that is infinite in its progression, and that literally the beyond is for all entities, no matter how exalted in development, is inexhaustible. And that is attractive. There's always a chance for further research. There's always an unknown to be discovered. It isn't a matter of always trailing over trails that have been well marked. In the yogic way, there are well marked portions of trails. Aurobindo speaks of them. They have signposts. They're in the sutras. He said he could gallop over them at full speed. But it's the inexhaustible wilderness of the unknown beyond that is the fascinating part. Even more fascinating because there are dangers in it. The very fact you don't know whether there'd be a dissolution of your of all possibility of organized consciousness. I had evidence that that sort of thing could happen. I remember once when I was writing this up in the philosophy of consciousness without an object, that I got into it without realizing how deeply I was in it, in the very effort to formulate it. A very difficult material to formulate. And I was in it all of a sudden. And I began seeing concepts dissolved like pieces of metal you might drop into a chemical from Minsu. It just dissolved, disappeared. I had to stop the process because if you're going to manifest a thing, you've got to have these organs. But I had no objection to it. I really would have welcomed the dissolving and getting rid of all conceptual process and just go into that Elysian field of the formless. Very attractive. But there seemed to be a duty to return the conceptual organ. So you had to stop the process. The will does it. I found the will all very effective. I also had another time the experience that this same force could dissolve memory. I found myself forgetting the past. I stopped that. Because if you forgot the past far enough, how could you possibly return to Sankara? You might have the will to do it. You might have decided it was a thing you should do, moral judgment. But how could you return if you had forgotten it entirely? It would cease in your memory. But you can stop that too. Just be able to retain the memory. Not because you want to, because you're perfectly willing to have memory of this sordid realm of samsara as it is now to disappear. So you're stopping processes that you even will. You welcome their happening, but you know it's you're a traitor to your job if you let them continue. Now, here is the base. I've outlined the base of which, for that which I have to say. What I say that is based upon these realizations is not, thus I have heard. It is thus I have appearanced, to use your term, which I think is very good. It has in my, for me, authority. I do not assert that it has authority for anyone who hears me speak or reads what I write. That's a very different matter. But it has authority for me. What you will hear me say and have heard me say is only thus I have heard for you. Use it if it appeals to you. But your way may be another way. Your guru parampara line may be another line. And that's perfectly all right with me. I belong to the guru parampara line that descends from Buddha through Shankara and Christ. I do not belong to the guru parampara line that descends through Krishna to Aurobindo, for instance, and yet I honor it and respect it, but it's another line, not my line. I accept it perfectly well in that sense, and I want to know all I can about it, but we are each of us under the obligation to go the line which is our own proper one. What I have to offer is yours if you have use of it. So there's no obligation to use it. There's no offense to me if you don't. Get that point clearly established. Now, I'm speaking out of the authority that comes from the realizations, not from the scriptures that others have left. Although I respect and honor them and learn from them all that I can. In the last year, it suddenly dawned upon me that this is the 33rd year since 1936. That year was culminated in August 7th or September 9th. I don't know which is the more important date. But the high indifference came during the night between September 8th and 9th. There are certain reasons why 33 happens to be important with me, also in this case 3. And there's certain importance that it could have implied that this was a cycle to draw in. There's some evidence that that possibility has existed and maybe still exists. A year hence it may not. I'd live on to that. And it occurred to me very recently, the thing that I'm dealing with right now calls for a subtle state of being very close to the brink in order to carry out a certain line of cognition. In the borderline between life and death itself. You understand it. There's nothing unpleasant about it. I feel perfectly willing to take the chances involved. And there's nothing unpleasant about it at all. Only it's subtle. I come to the problem of trying to make a correlation between these states that I know and others that are known and named in the literature. Now, they don't come with tags. There isn't a tag attached to say the high indifference. Say, this corresponds to what in literature is called so-and-so. All that you have to go by is what others have said about those states and see how they correlate with what you have experienced in your own state. Or see how it fits in the schema that exists. Now, the state itself said of the high indifference, this transcends not only samsara, but nirvana in the ordinary sense. Now, that was out of the state itself. And that the first realization was at the threshold of nirvana, not a full entering in. It said also, this is, comes into the consciousness, it makes it possible to enter a nirvanic state or the samsaric state. What is there in literature that corresponds to such a state? You find it in the conception of paranirvana. Now that means I have to change my whole original conception of the relationship of a paranirvana to nirvana. I had the conception, here was samsara, here's nirvana, here's a deeper state in the same direction. It doesn't go that way. It changes to this form. Samsara on this side, nirvana on this side. Complementary opposites. Samsara means the whole cosmos. Last figures I've seen, they keep changing, is that it has a radius of 10 billion light years. All the galaxies, all the matter in it, all the space in it, and all that goes down into subatomic physics is in it, all that science studies is in it, all that most religion is concerned with is in it and doesn't get out of it. All of the lokas that we speak of are in it, heaven worlds and hells. Saints without yogic knowledge are as much bound in it as the sinner. The only difference is that whereas the sinner circles between hell and life here, the saint circles between a heaven world of some sort, what we usually call Devakrant, and life here. A pretty good saint might get 1,000,000 years up there, but he gets back. He's not out of samsara. And the hellies go through their process. They burn, they burn with their desires and clash and so on, down in their hells. And according to Swedenborg, they like it. And then they come back here and circle again. They're all locked in. Now, nirvana stands opposite to that. I'm putting it not above, but over to the left or the right, whichever way you want to put it. But these are polar opposites, that they're dynamically equivalent, but opposite in sense. But at our present stage, creatures get locked into one or the other. Hence, in the literature, it'll be said that he who takes nirvana is locked away from the rest of humanity. They're called the Patika Buddhists, those that do that. They're called spiritually selfish Buddhists. It's the Buddhas of compassion, therefore, are those who renounce this inconceivable bliss. I believe you can't imagine how wonderful it is. Who renounce it in order to help overcome the bad karma that this humanity has developed. Your field of action is limited by karma. There really isn't too much you can do. You can't pick a person up by the scruff of the neck and shove him into nirvana against his will, anything of that sort. You have to work along with his karma. You have to arouse an interest in him, a willingness and all of that, because you've got to respect the autonomy of the enemy, of the entity. There's no violating that. Permit it. And it limits your action. You can influence. You cannot compel. Everyone has to make his own decision. That's the right of every human entity. Now, avoiding the word soul, because the Buddhists have no use for it. There are times when I'd like to use it. Buddhists get around it by saying principle of consciousness, or be a difference of terms. Something, however, persists. Whether you call it soul or if you call it a principle of consciousness, that entity has an autonomy of its own, and even the greatest, the great Buddha himself, cannot pass upon that autonomy, but he can influence. He can give discourses. He can bring inductions and glimpses into the beyond. But each individual must choose for himself. Well, now nirvana, a locked in state, and samsara, a locked in state. Nirvana, a wonderful state to be in. But if you're locked in, you're not fully liberated. Now, an earlier conception of liberation, the conception I got out of System of the Vedanta, was if you got into moksha, there's nothing more to it. You've got everything then. You've got full liberation. Now I have to say it isn't so. You certainly haven't got liberation if you're merely in heaven. The saints are in trouble. They have to be redeemed as well as the sinners. Your key to a nirvanic state is not simply goodness, it's equilibrium. Equilibrium between the pairs of opposites, including that pair of opposites which is good and evil. Now there's the shocking thing, it's very hard for people to take. Well, one may be tempted to say, do I mix evil deliberately with my goodness? No, that won't get you anywhere. But here, you can recognize the fact that you're not separate from the sins of humanity. They are your sins, too, even though you personally do not indulge in them. By that recognition, you can reach an equilibrium between the root of the good and evil. The equilibrium is very fine. Now everything here, every cognition, a possibility of cognition here, is based upon the principle of contrast of opposites. We do not know up except in contrast to down. We do not know good except in contrast to evil. And so on through our whole field of cognition. It's fundamental. You've got to bring together these opposites, these things that are separate, essentially are separate in the structure of samsara, into a state of equilibrium, a poise, before those gates from nirvana will open. Except that if your virtue and merit brings you to the attention of a qualified guru who can initiate into the nirvanic state, then through his initiatory power, you may be introduced into it. The Pratika Buddhas, I presume, do not earn the service of such gurus, and therefore must do it on their own, and therefore I have a lot of respect for their ability. But they're been spiritually selfish, they are locked in. They are therefore not fully liberated. You're not fully liberated till you can freely move between the samsaric and nirvanic state. The Pratika Buddha then is an object for redemption as truly as the people in samsara. Now you see, we've gone beyond. Not only the sinners, but also the saints need redemption and the Pratika Buddhas need redemption. They're fully redeemed when they're free to freely move through all these states without attachment that holds them one way or the other. now instead of the picture of a Namanakaya who has renounced Nirvana, the great renunciation, for a well nigh eternity of time, where your wed's woe was put in the words of the voice of the silence. He has renounced the Dharmakaya. In place of that, I envisage a Trikaya, one who is Nirmanakaya, Sambhogakaya, and Dharmakaya, all at once, and free to rove through all these three realms. One who can bring the refreshment of Nirvana to the parched lips of the dwellers in samsara. And he himself knows not of suffering, but this is a service of delight, where there is no renunciation. But a movement in the delight of a full existence in which there is the joy of bringing to those who are suffering in the ignorance the refreshment of the full light, something that is not a sad task, but a delight to perform. Freed himself, bringing that freedom to others. And in the end, not destroying samsara, but redeeming samsara as well as the creatures within it. Not junking it, as some of the exoteric literature suggests, but retaining it as a valuable training ground. Not a mere voidness, as the Buddhists, exoteric Buddhism says. Not a mere maya, as Shankara says. But a training ground in which consciousness grows to the point where, at last, it can be conscious of itself. And that is Buddhahood. And that will be enough for tonight.